Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Economics in the Age of COVID-19 by Joshua Gantz, narrated by Barry Abrams. Publisher's note: this audiobook refers to figures included in the print and ebook editions of the book. The MIT Press first reads, Series Forward. We are living in a moment of unprecedented crisis. The international spread of COVID-19 and the measures taken by governments to halt transmission of the virus are happening at a scale unlike anything seen in our lifetimes. As we grapple with the implications of social distancing and the tragic loss of human life, we need resources to help us make sense of this crisis. The MIT Press mission challenges us to meet the need for reliable information at such a time. In this spirit, we offer the MIT Press First Reads series. These rapidly produced digital-first titles will provide expert insight to inform matters of urgent local and global consequence. Our first book of the series is Economics in the Age of COVID-19 by Joshua Gantz. In this book, economist Joshua Gantz steps back from the short-term chaos to take a clear and systematic look at how economic choices are being made in response to COVID-19. He outlines the phases of the pandemic economy, from containment to reset to recovery and enhancement. The publication of this book reflects our effort to respond quickly to the need for timely information without sacrificing rigor or editorial quality. This ebook was written in the midst of the unfolding crisis, with input from expert peer reviewers. We plan to publish an updated edition of this book in both print and electronic formats in the fall of 2020, with additional content addressing questions and issues that arise over the next few months, and responding to feedback received from an open peer review process taking place on PubPub, an open access platform for community publishing. We hope that the information contained here helps you navigate through this uncertain time. Preface. On September 26, 2001, The Onion headline read, "Not knowing what else to do, woman bakes American flag cake." That was the feeling I had at the onset of the COVID-19 pandemic in March 2020. I found myself unable to get work done and constantly obsessing over news and then data on topics that I knew very little about. I was in self-isolation, having traveled to the United States. Upon reflection, not knowing what else to do, I decided I would do what I was good at. I'd write a book. I would endeavor to explain some of the broader economic issues arising from the pandemic to a wide audience. In this task, I was hampered by two things. First, and this is what every economist writing about this has been saying, I am not an epidemiologist. That meant I was absorbing that material as an amateur, and so had to be cautious regarding my own understanding. So, I would be flying well beyond what the usual academic norms would dictate, which meant I had to be careful in making any claims. That said, my goal here was to explain the economic issues of all this, and in that task, I was very experienced. Second, things were moving fast. Policies were changing. Scientists were learning more about the virus and its disease. No one had the information to create an appropriate assessment to evaluate the reasonableness of decisions being made, although everyone, including myself, had opinions they were willing to put all over social media. But if this book was going to be relevant in a month, let alone a year's time, as I wanted it to be, I was going to have to refrain from being judgmental. That meant that there would be no politics or even applause for what seemed like the best policies, nor disdain for what seemed like the worst. For readers looking for that, you will have to get that elsewhere. In the end, what we have here is a hastily written book that no doubt leaves out citations to many who deserve it. Its purpose is to be an urgent source of clarification and a thoughtful take on the issues. In so doing, I was forecasting what we would potentially take away from this crisis and what we would want to reflect upon beyond the chaos of the first month or so. I'm hoping not to be completely wrong about all of that, but if I am, I will be the first one to call it out. I would like to thank my family with whom I am stuck in a house writing this. They put up with my crazy idea to push out a book when I could be less socially distant, at least inside our household. I would also like to thank Scott Adams, A.J. Agrawal, Pierre Azoulay, Hesky Bar-Isaac, Francesco Bova, Kevin Bryan, Eric Budish, Bruce Chapman, Ben Fine, Catherine De Fontenay, Alberto Galasso, Avi Goldfarb, Steve Hamilton, Richard Holden, Chris Joy, Stephen King, Scott Commoners, Mara Letterman, Andrew Lee, June Ma, Tiff Macklem, Barry Nalbuff, Bob Pindick, Eric Rasmussen, Paul Romer, Scott Stern, Alex Tabarrok, and Flavio Toxvere for helpful comments and discussions. A special thanks for commenters on PubPub, in particular Patty Steele, with their many suggestions that improved the book. I would also like to thank my constant companion through this, #EconTwitter, who alerted me to much of the research cited in this book. Finally, I owe a special debt to Emily Tabor and the MIT Press team for acting so quickly to get this project out there. Joshua Gans, April 2020. 1. Health before wealth.
We know what to do to bring our economy back to life. What we do not know how to do is to bring people back to life.
His Excellency William Addo Dankwa Nana Akufo-Addo, President of Ghana, March 26, 2020.
Everything is awful. The virus is awful. The immediate choices are awful. The future may be even more awful. We should have been more prepared. For almost a decade, one of the most popular apps was Plague Inc., 120 million downloads and counting. It showed us how diseases broke out and did their damage. When the COVID-19 outbreak hit, the app surged back to number one in China and was promptly banned in the country. In Plague Inc., you play the virus and your goal is to wipe out humanity. To the extent they have a goal, this isn't the goal of most viruses. Instead, it might be survival of its genetic structure, which would end should it wipe out its hosts. But never mind. From humanity's perspective, we would want to tool up on the tactics for viruses that would lead to extinction. COVID-19 is not that species-ending virus, but it does have some of the characteristics you would employ in Plague Inc. if you wanted to destroy us all. An inexperienced player normally goes for a highly infectious and deadly disease. But that is not the best course of action. First, because the virus is deadly, human scientists start working extra hard to stop the plague. Second, if you kill people too quickly, you actually slow down the rate of infection. Instead, what you want to do is find a way of infecting many people, preferably without any symptoms that would get the infection noticed. Then, you want to ramp up the disease after each infected person has spread it around, so that you overwhelm health centers before the world shuts down travel. COVID-19 fits that bill. People become infectious, many with no or just mild symptoms, but then there is a deadly movement into pneumonia, which takes some weeks of hospitalization to treat. It would do well, but not necessarily win Plague Inc. One thing that COVID-19 does, which was not an option for players of Plague Inc., is that it impacts different demographics in different ways. While anyone appears to be able to carry the virus and infect others, those who become very sick, requiring hospitalization, tend to be the elderly. That means that in dealing with COVID-19, the costs associated with reduced economic and social activity will disproportionately fall on the young, precisely the group that is less personally impacted. That is a recipe for a virus being able to divide and conquer those who need to mount a response by creating a debate regarding whether that fight was worth it. All this means that the real game is likely to last some time.
An awful choice.
In normal times, economists focus on the fact that we have limited resources and can only do so much. If we direct expenditures towards, say, public health, we are giving up something else. Thus, it is not surprising to see some economists reminding people of those trade-offs.
"We put a lot of weight on saving lives," said Casey Mulligan, a University of Chicago economist who spent a year as chief economist on Mr. Trump's Council of Economic Advisers. "But it's not the only consideration. That's why we don't shut down the economy every flu season. They're ignoring the costs of what they're doing. They also have very little clue how many lives they're saving."
This has the effect of causing some politicians and business leaders to embrace the notion that in dealing with a pandemic, we need to be conscious that if we push for public health, we are trading that off against a loss in economic health. The technique of thinking at the margin often serves us well. This is because we can narrow the argument and think in terms of tweaking or fine-tuning where we are now. In dealing with trade-offs, the economist asks, if we get a little more of something, how much of something else do we have to give up? In this case, thinking at the margin would ask, if we want to open up the economy a little more during a pandemic, how many lives would that cost? However, even in normal times, there is a strong argument, recently voiced by Paul Romer, that economists at least should stay away from trying to trade off economic costs with lives lost. Trade-offs, especially at the margin, are the economists' bread and butter, so it really shouldn't surprise us to see this being voiced during a time of pandemic. However, this misses a critical issue. Pandemics are not the time when trade-offs at the margin are appropriate. This book is about seeing the pandemic through an economics lens, so I am going to begin with the question of how to balance the needs of the economy with the needs of public health. The good news is that this can be done by integrating a simple epidemiological model with basic economic analysis. The starting point is to understand that at any given point in time, there is only so much we can produce. Broadly speaking, if we want to have better public health outcomes, we need to take resources from elsewhere, and so we can imagine that we get less of other stuff, which we would broadly call the economy. What makes these trade-offs easy to grasp is that when we talk about producing some more public health, we can then think about how much less of the economy we get. Moreover, we are also confident that as we push for each extra bit of health, the more of the economy we have to give up each time. So, if our public health is poor, it is relatively cheap in terms of a reduction in the economy to get more of it. When our public health is already prioritized, pushing the system further to gain even more health is relatively expensive in terms of reductions to the economy. Thus, we do end up balancing, and we don't have the best imaginable public health outcomes because, frankly, we have decided not to pay the price. In the technical interlude at the end of this chapter, I put all of this discussion in graphical terms that might be familiar to an Econ 101 student, the production possibilities frontier. You can delve into that, or skip as you see fit. One reason a pandemic is awful is because it constrains even further what we can do with our scarce resources. We can neither sustain the level of the economy we had before without a decline in public health, nor vice versa. That, in and of itself, would not pose an issue for our ability to fine-tune. Instead, there are two factors that fundamentally mean that we can no longer fine-tune and instead face a choice between prioritizing public health or the economy without the ability to balance those choices. Those two factors are, one, that a pandemic hollows out our ability to maintain the same balance between health and the economy, and two, that our choice of priority changes our options going forward. That is, they can drift. Let's begin with hollowing out. Recall that our ability to obtain our current balance of health and the economy is that we recognize that having a little more health or a little more economy is not worth the price in terms of what we give up for each. Absent other innovations, say a vaccine or, as I will discuss later, testing, the way to achieve our previous level of public health in the face of a pandemic is to socially distance. That means that we cannot physically interact with one another, and therefore, to a very large extent, we can no longer produce the economic outcomes we once could. The problem is that the pandemic now changes the price of obtaining a little improvement in the economy. In order to do that, we must now give up a large degree of health, as the infection rate of COVID-19 is high. Being able to have slightly larger groups of people interact, or have a few workplaces open, poses a potentially high risk to public health because of the way the coronavirus can spread. Put simply, the option of sacrificing a little public health for having a little more economy is no longer open to us. This also works on the flip side. One option for dealing with a pandemic is simply to ignore it and let life go on as usual. The hope from that plan would be to maintain the economy at its previous level, see the virus spread through much of the population, hope not too many people die, and have a 1 to 2 year large decline in public health. This was sometimes referred to as allowing the virus to burn through the population. Even here, the ability to fine-tune is compromised. You might want to achieve a slightly lower loss of life from the pandemic, but find now that the price of doing that, as even that would require a large amount of social distancing, has become very high. Hollowing out means that you no longer want to maintain the same balance of the economy and health as you did previously. Instead, the best choices are to prioritize one or the other. There is a trade-off, but no longer can you dial up a little bit more of this and a little bit less of that. You either prioritize the economy or you prioritize public health. You don't want to try to do both. One thing that can tip the balance is that you may not be able to maintain the economy at its previous level if you just let the pandemic burn through the population. This is because, like a war or natural disaster, we lose resources if we have much lower public health. That is, our workforce becomes smaller. Thus, if we let a pandemic run its course without mitigation that lowers economic activity, what happens is what I call a dark recession. This is a recession where we see a reduction in the availability, ability, and health of the workforce as the virus spreads unabated. This causes a large reduction in economic activity. We have some evidence that suggests that a failure to abate the spread of the virus through social distancing can make economic recovery thereafter more difficult. Economists have examined the differences in non-pharmaceutical pandemic interventions across different U.S. cities during the flu pandemic of 1918. The pandemic reduced U.S. manufacturing by an estimated 18%, making it a large recession indeed. Those cities that pushed earlier and more intensively on pandemic containment ended up bouncing back and having higher economic growth thereafter, and more exposed areas had a decline in economic activity that persisted. This finding suggests that the choice between the economy and public health is not a hard one. Pursuing public health can be consistent with superior long-run economic performance. The drift. Thus far, an analysis of what we can produce in a pandemic has shown that we face a stark choice between prioritizing public health or the economy without the ability to fine-tune those trade-offs. However, epidemiological models have another implication that suggests the choice is more difficult than even that stark one. The options can drift depending on how we respond to the pandemic. Put simply, the longer you take to enact social distancing, the fewer options you have. This means that you can no longer achieve the existing level of health and must accept less. This is the drift. your ability to generate higher levels of public health during the pandemic is reduced unless you commit to holding the line on health. Importantly, if you spend too long trying to maintain the previous balance between the economy and public health, you are unable to achieve better levels of public health at all. Importantly, the drift goes in only one direction. If you choose to prioritize the economy and maintain previous levels of economic activity, you may cut off the option of improving public health at all. You no longer have the option to buy more public health through a reduction in economic activity. Prioritizing the economy too aggressively is like going through a one-way door. There is no exit. Instead, holding the line on health initially is the superior way to go. It is the only direction that gives you the option of making a choice once you have learned more information regarding what the pandemic's effects on your options actually look like. Consequently, from an economics perspective, the fact that supporting the economy makes the decision irreversible by changing the pandemic production options means that you should be biased towards sacrificing the economy and maintaining the line on public health. Resolve. Economics tells us that the optimal response to a pandemic is to resolutely hold the line on health while you consider your options. It is critical to prioritize health before wealth until such time as you learn enough information to understand the nature of the pandemic. Holding the line is a difficult coordination challenge. Expectations matter. To hold the line on health, you need to change the behavior of large numbers of people. It is easy to social distance when others are doing so. It is easy to practice good hygiene when you fear others around you will stigmatize you if you don't. But the flip side of this is that if you cannot achieve that convergence of expectations, you may not be able to achieve significant progress in holding a virus at bay. This is why resolve, clarity, transparency, and other instruments that can help align expectations are so critical. When leaders downplay the magnitude of the crisis or take actions that seem to be guidelines rather than expected behavior with consequences, expectations do not converge. Instead, rather than taking actions that make sense in the public or societal interest, individuals will continue to do as they often do and pursue their own interest. They will keep businesses open and keep engaging in social life. That creates a vicious cycle that makes it harder to hold the line on health and may necessitate more costly policies by governments to contain the outbreak. The cost will be lost time and, by extension, lost lives. Given this, you might have thought the world's population would have been better prepared to act quickly on this. However, it is harder than you think, as it requires a faith in mathematical predictions that is not easy to come by. Chapter 2 is about such predictable surprises. It discusses why the mathematics of cumulative processes are so difficult to understand and make decisions on. When we look back on this, I suspect the postmortems will tell us we should have acted sooner. In reality, sooner was measured in days. That is a tough standard for decisions that turned out to be vastly consequential. Phases of the pandemic economy. The remainder of the book is structured along the lines of various phases that arise for the economy during a pandemic. The four phases are illustrated in Figure 1.1. At a high level, these steps communicate a view regarding the hoped-for endgame from the COVID-19 panic. The overarching goal is to reduce the rate of infection such that the pandemic ends. This is distinct from a goal of eradicating the virus entirely, as we have with smallpox, for instance. In other words, cases of COVID-19 may well continue for some time, but their ability to spread in an uncontrolled manner will be curtailed. Nonetheless, how precisely that end game is achieved, that is, how a sufficient share of the population becomes immune, involves choices that will be outlined in the chapters that follow. The first phase is containment. This involves three steps. The first, as already noted, is that the virus, outbreak, and potential pandemic have to be identified. This is the subject of Chapter 2. While this is going on, the pandemic is playing itself out unabated. Following this is a step that is designed to put the brakes on and stop the virus from spreading. This is the initial part of holding the line to learn more about the virus and to preserve potentially scarce economic resources. The decisions that must be made then are akin to those made by governments during wartime. They involve immediate sacrifice, and, as I point out in Chapter 3, they require an approach to resource allocation that would, at all other times, be considered repugnant. Centrally planned economies. But this is where governments, appropriately, have started to act. There are centralized and military-run operations to improve healthcare system capacity. There are price controls and subsequent rationing. And there are blanket restrictions on movement. None of these things would have been achievable under a free market regime, and all of these actions have the potential to save many lives and ultimately preserve our economy. The costs of those decisions are very hard to fathom. Perhaps the largest contraction in economic activity since the Great Depression is taking place, and this is by choice so we could reduce the spread of COVID-19. The impact of that has been unevenly felt, with growing numbers of unemployed and bankruptcies from small and medium-sized businesses occurring. How to use government policy, both fiscal and monetary, is not simple. In Chapter 4, I explain that this type of recession is very different from past recessions and requires a distinct approach. The goal would be to somehow pause the economy so that it could be later unpaused and life could return to normal. Thus, we wouldn't let businesses fail and people lose their jobs. They need to be insulated. We need policies, in particular loans, to keep people from breaking economic relationships, either because businesses shut down or jobs are shed. If COVID-19 is successfully contained, the next phase is to reset everything and start from scratch. A critical insight when thinking about pandemics is that the problem we face is a lack of knowledge. We do not know who is infectious and who might be safe from infection. If we have this knowledge, we can isolate the infectious until they recover and prevent the virus from spreading while maintaining much of our economic and social life. In Chapter 5, I describe this reset phase as a move to a testing economy. In that economy, we test widely to determine who is safe to interact with others. Then we repeat that until such time as a vaccine is distributed or the virus has otherwise abated. In this way, moving to a testing economy can expand our production possibilities. This is what we would have liked to do at the outset, but lacked either the information or the means to do so. It highlights that the role of the containment phase is effectively to get us back to square one and have a do-over based on better knowledge going forward. Having reset and developed a means of testing, we will be able to begin the recovery phase from the pandemic. In Chapter 6, I consider the economic issues associated with reemergence. There will be a need to prioritize who is released from isolation, as not all of the population will be designated safe for interactions. This is based on network theory, which can give us guidance as to what types of jobs, workplaces, and other factors can serve as criteria for release. In reemergence, we will also face rationing of certain things, most notably vaccine doses, and we'll need to consider how those scarce resources are allocated. Chapter 7 then looks at a related but also ongoing part of the recovery, the need to rally innovation. Innovations will be needed for tests, treatments, and vaccines for COVID-19, but also for dealing with pandemics in the future. The fundamental problem is that these innovations are global public goods that we want wide distribution of. But the urgency and other factors mean that normal market-based processes of innovating are not going to succeed. Instead, I discuss various tools that might accelerate innovations, including advanced market commitments to purchase the products based on innovations. These can overcome some of the incentive-dampening pressures that might otherwise emerge for innovators in this area. Finally, having evolved from the current crisis, we will reach a new phase, the future. My assumption here is that, like the major crises of the past, we...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?